This is Deanna Spingola. It is Thursday, December 6, 2012, and this is one of my special interviews. We have no commercials, no censorship, no calls, and no music. It is just education and information. It is bare bones broadcasting. My guest today is ZCF. People know him as ZCF, but he has another name also, and that name is Xander C. Fuerza. Did I say that last name correctly?
That's right, Xander C. Fuerza.
Okay. The website is ZionCrimeFactory.com. Welcome to the program.
Well, I'm glad to be here. I was very excited to come back because I've been kind of laying low the past month or so because I've been diligently working on my book. And there's a lot of distractions out there, and the internet is a huge distraction. I'm getting like 400 to 500 comments on my site, and I'm having to moderate the comments. And there's people fighting and bickering there, and I have to be the babysitter and deal with it. And it's a huge distraction. And I'm just trying to set all that aside, all this internet stuff, just focus on writing my book, getting it finished, getting it out there. And I'm excited about that.
Now, do you have a name for it yet?
I do have a name for it. I don't want to give it out just yet.
I kind of think that you have a lot of distraction on your website because people are deliberately attempting to distract you from your main goal and objectives. I think it's deliberate. I know that sounds conspiratorial.
It is deliberate, and there's a lot of trolls and there's a lot of degenerates within the movement itself. There's a lot of people who just spend all of their days just starting fights on comment boards and forums and just trolling people, and this is the least productive thing you could possibly be doing. And I fell into some of that stuff when I first got into the truth movement too. It's hard to, trolls have a way of sucking you into a conversation dragging it out and provoking you, and it's easy to get into a big argument with somebody in a comment board. But the way I have my site set up is if you post a comment and you've never posted a comment before, then I have to approve one comment. And then if I approve one comment, then you can post freely after that.
Mm-hmm.
So what that does is it kind of isolates the overt trolls who immediately come to the site and start, spewing garbage and attacking me or whatever. They can't get through my screen. So that's just one way I prevent these Hasbara, these JIDF type scumbags from ruining my site.
Mm-hmm. Now, I think, too, that some of them are, they may be working for somebody, Cyanium or something of that nature. I don't think that there are a lot of people who would be so silly as to waste hours and hours each day just trolling, just making trouble for people, unless they were being well paid.
Exactly. There's no way people could have that much time on their hands to spend days and nights just, attacking people and spewing ad hominem BS all over people's websites. That has to be somebody who's literally being paid to do it. And, there is a program. The Israeli government has this program where they pay people to troll internet websites, social media sites, Facebook. And I'm sure they send them to sites like mine as well.
Sure. I also think that they profile people. And they profile you to figure out, what is going to irritate this person? What is going to annoy this person? What are some of the vulnerabilities that this individual has? And I think that they probably start trolling to figure it out, and then they go after that vulnerability when they identify it. And I don't know, everybody likes to be well thought of, and if somebody says something that is outrageously outrageous about you or against you, I have a tendency to to respond. However, I've come to recognize that it's just not worth the trouble. And it,
Right.
It makes you feel more powerful to just delete stuff.
Well, they try to get under your skin. They try to
Sure.
make it about you personally instead of what you're saying, the information you're presenting. They try to make it all about the truth teller and him personally, him or her, whoever's giving this information, when that's not what it's about. It's not about me. It's not about you. It's about the information that we're presenting, whether it's true or false. And they cannot refute what we say, so they have to attack us personally. And that's what we
Right.
see happening.
I have somebody that's relatively close to me who I've suspected of being a psychopath for at least 2 to 3 years, and this person has, as I say, is very close to me, and I made an accusation which was very, very accurate, and all of a sudden. I am an anti-Semite. I am a Hitler lover. I am a racist, and I'm a hateful person.
Well,
And yet, a week ago, I was a wonderful, wonderful person until I just accused this person of telling a lie. And when you are incapable of actually addressing an issue, then you go on the attack. And what these people do, they are really showing their juvenile tendencies, and they're showing their total inadequacies as far as addressing the issue. They're really very ignorant, and they really don't know what they're talking about. And if people actually did the research that you have done, that I have done, they will recognize that yes, there are some questions about the Holocaust, but if you've been indoctrinated by the government schools and you believe everything that the government tells you, then you're going to demonstrate your ignorance by making false accusations and by accusing people of being racist or whatever.
And that's the standard tactic that is utilized is name calling and ad hominem attacks. And I would take all of those terms, those phrases, anti-Semite, Hitler lover, I would take those as compliments. You know you're doing something right when they call you an anti-Semite because you're speaking the truth about the ruling elite, the Jewish power elite that controls this world. And if you're not being called an anti-Semite, then you're not telling the truth. That's the simple fact of the matter. If you're talking about globalists and Illuminati and reptiles, you're not going to be called an anti-Semite because you're not identifying the real criminals behind what's really going on.
Right.
So, I always go back to that quote that Hitler says, where if you're not being slandered and vilified and castigated in the Jewish newspapers in the morning, then you didn't do your job the day before. You spent the previous day to no account. And I always go back to that, and that gives me inspiration.
How true. How true.
I also wanted to mention this past couple weeks, I've been following the Arthur Topham situation. He's been under a vicious and relentless onslaught led by Jewish supremacist organizations and the RCMP, who have targeted our good friend Arthur Topham to be sent to prison. They are targeting his website to be taken down, to be completely extinguished from the internet. They want to shut him up and make sure that he can never speak again. And he's been giving these updates, these legal updates on his site. He's still posting on his site. He's defiant and he's courageous, and he's going to continue to speak the truth despite the fact that they are charging him and they're building some sort of fraudulent and fabricated case against him. And a few interesting things happened, one of which was he posted an article that I wrote about him. I wrote it, posted it on my website. I called it The Jewish Supremacist Onslaught Against Arthur Topham. And he posted it on his website, and he gave a legal update where at one of these preliminary hearings, the lawyer for the prosecution side is a raving lunatic, and she was irate that he was continuing to post articles on his website that they believe was the same caliber material as they're charging him for. But she apparently read off some of these quotes, these headlines from his website, and one of them was simply the title of my article, The Jewish Supremacist Onslaught Against Arthur Topham. And she pulled the line out of my article where I said something like, Canada is under a brutal Jewish occupation. Now, if there is not a Jewish supremacist onslaught against Arthur Topham, if there isn't a brutal Jewish occupation of Canada, then Arthur Topham would not be in the situation that he finds himself in. He would not be being pursued by the RCMP and other criminal police organizations who do the bidding of these Zionist supremacist groups like the B'nai B'rith. He wouldn't be in this position. Absolutely not. There would be no hate speech law in Canada, and you wouldn't get in trouble for criticizing Jews if Jews didn't have control of the government and the judicial system. It's just common sense and logic. And if Arthur was saying what he says about Jews and Zionism, if he was saying that about Arabs and Islam, he would not be charged with hate speech. He would probably get a good job as a writer at one of these neoconservative propaganda outlets like the National Post or something like
of
that.
Of course, or he'd be on Fox News or something like that.
Absolutely.
It is amazing. If there weren't so much Semitism, there wouldn't be anti-Semitism, as they say. And they're proving your logic, and hopefully there will be some people that will get, because of their publicity of this case, there will be people who will come to your website and read your things and say, you know, I think this this gentleman has something here. So they're just calling attention to something that that is going to make them look bad, not to Arthur. I mean, he's what? He's 65 years old. He's an old man. He doesn't have, he is, I shouldn't call him an old man, but he's an older gentleman. And how much of a threat could he be, for goodness sake?
Right. He's not a threat to anybody. And the only reason they're going after him is because he's exposing the real threat. And that's the Jewish power elite and their minions, their evil helpers in the governments of the West. And they did actually, there was a television show called The Source, and this Zionist Jew is the host of the show. His name's Ezra Levant, and he had Douglas Christie, who's the lawyer for Arthur Topham, and he was the lawyer for Ernst Zundel, and he had Douglas Christie on to talk about Arthur Topham. And on the show, this raving, he purports to be pro-free speech, but the only reason that he's supportive of freedom of speech is because he wants to be able to vilify the Muslims so that Westerners go and fight wars for Israel. He's a raving Zionist. But he said on this show he was castigating Arthur Topham, he was slandering Arthur Topham, he was vilifying him, he was calling him all kinds of names. He said, "I hate Arthur Topham." He was just bashing Arthur in every possible way.
Oh my goodness.
But he flashed on the screen a number of images from Arthur's website, and one of them was the article that I'd written that Arthur posted on his site with the title, and he included, you know, my screen name, Zion Crime Factory, in the title of the article. So that was actually flashed on national television, so people saw that and probably went to my site to see what it's all about. So I sort of unintentionally, he gave me some publicity there. So that was also interesting.
Sure. And the fact that, while you mentioned that they prosecute this these hate crimes selectively, they're not going after the people that are talking about the Muslims or any other person, any other group of people. It is just very selective. And this is the tactics that they have always used from the time that they, from 1843 forward. And in fact, I was looking at some, at during the so-called Civil War here in this country, I was looking at Grant's order, number 11 today. And the minute that he created that order, which basically banished or expelled some of the Jewish traders who were trading back and forth. They were buying cotton in the South and making a lot of money. I mean, they were going back and forth and had their ha had the ability to travel in the South, and it was really bothering General Grant. So he issued this Order 11, and within 24 hours, President Lincoln said, "Oh no, we cannot do this." And in fact, there was an article in the newspaper of the day. It was a couple of years after the fact, after the wars in 1868, and talking about this and why they were doing it, why he did this. And turned out that General Grant later on said, "Oh, well, I was wrong. I really shouldn't have done that." And then when he became president, he had a lot of Jewish people as part of his administration. And so this idea that you cannot criticize what they're doing, even though it is dangerous to the rest of the people in the country, even though it is making money at the expense of others, even though it is making war profits while people are dying and being slaughtered, you can't say anything about that. You cannot say a single word about that because they have such control over the government. In fact, even back during the Civil War, they had control over the government. And one of the things that this article brought to my attention was, and I talked about this a little bit in my book, is that Lincoln wrote a letter. I was going to say an email. Wrote a letter to somebody that he had served with in the Illinois legislature. Oh gosh, I
Right.
just in the Illinois House. Okay,
Yeah.
and he was saying, "Oh, I just hate anti-Semitism. I think it's so racist." And he was referring to this another gentleman who was serving in the same capacity. And then all of a sudden, this became very popular. This letter got out, and all of a sudden, he got the Jewish vote in 1860. And some of the delegates who went to the Republican National Convention were Jewish, and they pushed him right in. Because he made it known that yes, he was for the Jews, and then of course when he got in, he protected them by rescinding General Grant's order. Now I'm not a big fan of General Grant, but he was right, and but it didn't do any good because he had the power behind him, he had the government behind him, he had the president behind him, and apparently this is true in many countries in the country, and it's true where Arthur Topham resides in Canada.
Well, pandering to the Jews is how you make your way in politics. If you pledge your allegiance to Zion, then you will make your way up to the highest levels of power in the Western world. And that's just a simple fact that everybody can see for themselves. Especially, talking about Arthur Topham of Canada, Stephen Harper, the Prime Minister of Canada, is the most servile and slavish puppet of the Jews that's ever existed in the Western world. Even more so than Obama, even more so than some of these European leaders. This guy is 100% supportive of everything that Israel does. If Israel rounded up 100,000 Palestinians tomorrow and executed them, Stephen Harper would applaud this action. He would cheer and applaud and say that this was justified. This is how much of a puppet this guy is. He puts a yarmulke on his head. It's almost like he's always wearing a yarmulke. He is literally an honorary Jew. He works for them totally, completely. There's nothing else that he does for the people of Canada. He doesn't do anything for the people of Canada. Everything that he does is in the service of the Jewish lobby. And, just speaking about these hate crime laws, of course they choose to prosecute these selectively because they're Jewish laws, they're Talmudic inspired laws. And if you're Jewish, you're allowed to hate other people. You're allowed to promote hatred of enemies of the Jews. If you don't like the Jews, don't like the Germans, and they can slander and vilify Germans. They don't today, they don't like the Muslims and the Arabs who are resisting Israeli imperialism, then they are free to slander and dehumanize Muslims in their press. And that's what they do. And then they prosecute anybody who criticizes Jews. It is obviously a Jewish law for Jewish benefit, and to prosecute anybody who challenges the Jew world order. That's all this is. And what's happening to Arthur Topham is just a perfect illustration that this new world order is simply a Jewish plan for world domination that's outlined in their holy text, that's outlined by the most revered rabbis and sages, that's outlined by David Ben-Gurion, talked about it, that the Jewish people would lead a world government based in Jerusalem, and that United Nations would be formed, and it would be centered in Jerusalem. He openly said stuff like this.
Right.
So the agenda is very obvious at this point, and the fact that they've gone after Arthur Topham so viciously, and other people like Ernst Zundel have gone through the same thing, it just illustrates everything that we're saying about them is correct.
Certainly. Well, you mentioned Ernst Zundel, and he's a wonderful, wonderful man. He is not hateful. He is just a fabulous person. And he had two trials in Canada, and those trials were just absolutely wonderful in that he brought in scientists, he brought in such wonderful people to testify in his behalf. He paid for Fred Leuchter to go to Germany to make scientific tests, and Fred Leuchter was, I think he was probably the most prominent, or maybe the only prominent expert in gas chamber development and engineering in the United States. And he went over to Germany, went to Auschwitz, and made the test, did the test, and proved beyond a shadow of a doubt that there was absolutely no way in the world that the big room that the Auschwitz officials were claiming was a gas chamber could have accomplished the thing that they have been saying. And it was after that,
right,
I believe, that they changed the numbers out on the plaque. In fact, they probably ought to just make it so that they can change it to, you know, on a regular basis, because at one point it said 4 million, and I think it's down to 1.5. And if you read the New York Times, and I believe it's 1991, I believe it was down to 73,000 with only 38,000. Now, 38 only sounds like a very small number.
Right.
But Auschwitz was not just a small camp. It was a huge complex. And when you talk about the deaths at any of the labor camps, you've got to figure in the sanitation, the hygiene, the lack of food because of the Allied bombing. And all of this came out in this huge book. I think it's like a 600-page book that was compiled after the trial. And anybody that's read that would not believe in the government version of what happened during World War II, would not believe all of this vilification of Germans in Germany. And but by silencing Arthur and by silencing other people in Canada, they're moving the focus off of probably Ernst Zundel. And look what they did to him. I mean, he moved here to the United States, moved to Tennessee, got married, and then the government of Canada and the government of the United States worked together in order to deport him back to Germany. He hasn't lived in Germany for years.
Right. The two trials that Ernst Zundel went through was a huge breakthrough for Holocaust revisionism. He got together a huge team of revisionists, a brain trust of revisionists, to come together and essentially debunk the Holocaust in court. And the amazing thing about that is that Ernst Zundel is not a rich man. He didn't have a lot of money to pay for all this, but he got donations and they pulled their money together and they came up with all of these experts to come to Toronto and give testimony that the Holocaust simply is not what they're telling us that it was. And he actually got the Holocaust Pope Raoul Hilberg to testify, who's the leading Holocaust dogmatist out there, and he admitted that the two things that have completely annihilated the official story of the Holocaust, and that's that there's no scientific document, no autopsy report proving that anyone had died of gas poisoning. And he also admitted that there is not a single German document that illustrates a plan or a policy to kill the Jews, that every single German wartime document referred to a final solution of deportation, that the final solution of the Jewish question was to deport the Jews. First, they just thought of Madagascar as a good, you know, possible solution. And once that fell through, it didn't go according to plan. They decided to deport them to the east, to the occupied territories in the Soviet Union. So that's the two main tenets of the Holocaust story have been shot down at this trial and admitted by this leading Holocaust quote-unquote expert. And, you know, that trial totally just revolutionized the whole movement and brought so many findings to the table that wouldn't have happened if they didn't go after him, if they didn't attack him, and if they didn't try to jail him, then that would have never happened. Those people would have never got together, and they would have never done that kind of research, and we probably still say 4 million at Auschwitz, you know, perished. But they had to change the numbers, and they continually change the numbers, and that should tell you right there that we're being lied to. Why do they have to change the numbers? And then they reduce the death toll at several of these major camps by millions. But somehow the 6 million, the sacrosanct 6 million figure remains unchanged. And media organizations and historians repeat this figure verbatim to this day, even though they've admitted that nowhere near 6 million died. They've admitted that themselves, the official historians. But they continue to promote this number because it has a religious significance. It comes from the Torah and the Talmud. It's a Jewish religious idea that it originates in the Torah. And that's why they promote it. And Raoul Hilberg admitted that as well. He says, the numbers matter. You can call it religious. And that was his explanation for why they continually they have this fixation on this 6 million myth.
Right. And certainly, there were never 6 million Jews under German occupation to begin with. And if you read Walter Sanning's book, which is very detailed, he talks about all of the numbers and talk. And I believe it's called "Dissolution of the European Jewry." And I'm going through that book right now, and there is absolutely no way when you figure in the immigration and everything else from the area between the two wars, whether you're talking about Poland, whether you're talking about Germany or any of the other European countries, there was a lot of immigration. And in fact, the leaders in the Soviet Union, one of the first group of people that they decided to have flee or to escape were the Jews. They made arrangements for the Jews to leave because they knew that things were going to become bad, and so they allowed them to leave. And many people left. Many of the Jews left before anything ever occurred.
Yeah, several million Jews, in fact, were evacuated from Poland deep into the heart of the Soviet Union before the Germans even arrived at that area.
Right.
And, you know, those Jews survived the war. Many of them actually funneled back into Poland after the war in 1945 and filled the communist regime of Poland and began executing and slaughtering Germans.
Right.
You know, John Sack, this Jewish guy, wrote a book called An Eye for an Eye, in which he details the fact that Joseph Stalin set up 1,255 communist concentration camps after the war and put Jews in charge of them.
Right.
Now,
yes,
if all the Jews were killed, if they were slaughtered by the millions, and how are there so many Jews still alive after the war, and how are they able to exact quote-unquote revenge for something that didn't happen, but nonetheless, they unleashed a murderous onslaught against the Germans after the war in these communist concentration camps. And of course, the Red Army perpetrated the mass rape of several million German women at the end of the war and the murder, indeed the murder of hundreds of thousands, if not millions, of German civilians and prisoners of war in 1945. And the funny thing is that the 6 million nonsense, you can debunk it just with one observation. And that's that in late 1945, Ilya Ehrenberg, he was this Soviet communist propagandist, a Jew, a fanatical Jewish supremacist, and he came out with that 6 million number too early. He came out with it in late 1944. He had written this obscene propaganda text called the Black Book, in which he invented pure fiction war propaganda against Germany. He talked about steam chambers. He talked about Jews being turned into soap and lampshades and bone powder, just ridiculous horror stories. And he comes out with that 6 million figure before the war is even over. There's still 6 months left of the war to be fought. Jews would have perished after that time, yet he says 6 million Jews had died in 1944, late 1944, early 1945. He's already saying this. He's already peddling this fable that 6 million had died. That in itself, without even looking at all the other evidence, and there's plenty, that in itself should tell you that this is a premeditated hoax. And then when you go back into history, we find that they've promulgated this 6 million figure hundreds of times before World War II, before World War I. They were claiming back in 1906 that the Russian Tsar had a policy to kill 6 million Jews, Russian Jews. That's obviously a fable. And even in the late 1800s, they were pushing this as well. And it's just a Kabbalistic fable to basically facilitate Zionism. They needed an excuse. They needed a pretext. They needed a justification to occupy Palestine, to ethnically cleanse and commit a real genocide against the Palestinians. And the way to do that was to invent this myth that 6 million Jews had died, of the most persecuted and victimized people in the world, and promote this widely, promote this all over the world, which they have done. They have a Holocaust industry of movies, books, memoirs, and they push this constantly. Every year there's new movies about it. And, you know, Zionism is the very basis of this myth, because back in 1900, a Zionist rabbi named Stephen Wise, he let slip this plan. And he said there are 6 million living, bleeding, suffering arguments in favor of Zionism. Back in 1900, this is before World War I, before World War II, and he was the leading rabbi pushing the gas chamber propaganda in America. He was the leading guy that was promoting all this war atrocity propaganda. So it's very obvious when you look at the evidence that this is a hoax, and it is essentially the foundation of the New World Order, what they call the New World Order, what I call the Jew World Order. That is based entirely on this Holocaust myth, and that was stated by an official of the B'nai B'rith. His name was Ian J. Kagadan. In 1991, he said that the Holocaust story is central to the New World Order, and achieving their quest of a New World Order depends on your learning the Holocaust lessons. And this is the B'nai B'rith, the same organization that is trying to persecute Arthur Topham, the same organization that went after Ernst Zundel. It is a Jewish supremacist New World Order group, and they are using this Holocaust propaganda to browbeat the Gentiles into slavery, into servitude.
Now, that article, where was that article posted? I believe I read it. Was that in the New York Times, that he actually admitted this, that the whole thing depended, that the whole order depended on pushing that myth? And
yeah, that was not in the New York Times. That was in a Canadian newspaper called the Toronto Star.
Oh, right. Okay.
And he says that, you know, openly and brazenly, he says that memorializing this myth is the very basis of the New World Order. So, you know, it comes from their own mouths. We don't have to – we're not inventing this stuff. We're not just making this stuff up and attributing to them. They say it themselves openly and brazenly, and we just quote them. And then they want to throw you in jail for quoting them. It's amazing.
Yes, indeed. And that is what you're very good at, is in using their sources so that that you can take it right from their sources and let people draw their own conclusions. It is not, and I do this too. I don't believe that they can really justifiably say that people are committing hate crimes when so many of the revisionists, so many people, the researchers, use the documentation right from Jewish sources. How can they
Absolutely.
possibly then turn around and accuse people of hate crimes or of being hateful or anti-Semitic? How do they do that?
Well, because they're drunk on power and they're schizophrenic and they're delusional and they think they could just do whatever they want and look like idiots, look like little children, look like blatant hypocrites that they are. But they have all the power. They have the courts and the banks and the media in their hands, so they can get away with this type of nonsense. And
And
they
they also
are.
have the educational system. For instance, in the United States, I think all of the school districts now are required by law to teach a certain agenda where they teach the Holocaust, and they actually, the United States, the official United States Holocaust Memorial Museum located in Washington, D.C., and by the way, on public land, Congress gave them public land to build this museum on. And when you consider that it's part of their dogma, then you have basically you have a government that is favoring one religion over every other religion because this is part of their dogma. And so this museum has an educational system apparatus where they provide
AKA indoctrination, brainwashing center.
absolutely, and they teach all of the teachers. They also have state organizations that do the same thing, and so children are so vulnerable. They believe everything that their authority figure, the teacher, tells them. And it isn't happening just in the United States. It's happening in other European countries, where you have a music teacher that's teaching songs that people sang in the labor camps, or the history teacher, or some other teacher that's supposed to be teaching math. They're talking about the numbers that the Holocaust that died during the Holocaust. I mean, it's every teacher, no matter what she's supposed he or she is supposed to be teaching, they somehow incorporate the dogma of the Holocaust in there.
The religion of Holocaustianity. It's the new state religion of the West, and there's the churches are basically dwindling, and then there's more Holocaust museums being erected every year everywhere, all across the Western world, even in South America and Asia. They're putting this stuff up. They want to just totally submerge the entire planet under this propaganda cloak. And that Holocaust Memorial Museum, I consider that basically a criminal organization. It's a hate theme park. It's like a Disneyland style theme park. Not only do they bring children there to brainwash them and turn them into Zionists, but they also every year they bring FBI agents who are training to become FBI agents to this United States Holocaust Memorial Museum to indoctrinate the federal agents to be sympathetic to the Jews and Zionism, and to train them in the art of suppressing freedom of speech, suppressing the enemies of the Jews. They're not going there to learn objective history. They're going there to be brainwashed and to fill their heads with a dogma that causes them to literally have hatred of the people who have historically risen up against the Jews, and that's the Germans. And now today we see the Muslims are in the same position as the Germans were. And it's not a coincidence that the main group of people in the United States that is basically the victim of FBI criminality, of FBI corruption, FBI sting operations and whatnot, are Muslim Americans. Muslim Americans are constantly being targeted with phony charges of terrorism. They're being set up. They're being tricked and trapped in sting operations to propagate this war on terror BS, which has the same origins and the same cast of characters behind it. And it's the Jewish power elite once again. And they're using police organizations like the FBI, or in the case of Arthur Topham, the RCMP, to literally enforce Zion's iron rule in the Western world. It's unbelievably disturbing. And, you know, more people have to start waking up to this, or, you know, we could be next. Anybody could be next.
Sure. Now, aren't they also taking, aren't they also sending Mossad agents over here, or sending police to whole people, whole police departments over to Israel in order to instruct the police of large cities how to respond to you know, crises, riots, or whatever, and you see them.
Well, how to be psychopathic criminals and tyrannical maniacs who torture people and beat people down when they're protesting against corruption, against the evils of the government. That's what they're learning. They're going to Israel, and the Israelis are teaching them in all the tactics and the sinister things that they've been perpetrating against the Palestinians. And these police people come back to the U.S. and enact these sadistic policies against the American population. They're turning the U.S. into a Zionist gulag. And not only do these police officers go to Israel to get training, but the Anti-Defamation League of B'nai B'rith trains these police groups as well in the U.S. All across the nation, the ADL is the leading group that has this special relationship with the police organizations and intelligence agencies to train them in the art of subversion, basically, in the art of subversion, the art of deception, to suppress the dissent against this Jew world order that is enveloping the globe.
And then to make the population more receptive to this kind of treatment, since they do control Hollywood, since they control all of the networks, they have all of these police-style programs where they show the police busting into apartments or homes, and they've got SWAT team gear. And this is really very, it's a brainwashing technique. They're just getting everybody used to accepting this, and we see it on TV. And if you don't recognize what is going on, and then you think, oh, well, this is normal. This is, you know, they have to do this. They got to catch the criminals.
Yeah, that's what's called predictive programming. They show you an image of something, or they show you a narrative, a scenario over and over again, and it's like they predict it to you, and they keep repeating it over and over again. You see it so many times that you basically accept it when it does happen, and you fall right in line with what the response they were hoping to get from you. And you see this in my book. I have a short chapter about this predictive programming thing in regard to 9/11. And what happened was that back in March of 2001, a TV show aired on the Fox TV network called The Lone Gunman. And this show literally depicted a scenario where the U.S. government, a rogue faction in the U.S. government, carried out a false flag attack in which they hijacked a jumbo jet, a passenger plane, and attempted to fly it into the World Trade Center. It was the exact scenario that that happened on 9/11. It was the exact same narrative, but this is before 9/11. This is 6 months before the attacks happened. It's being broadcast on Fox TV, which is owned by Rupert Murdoch, who's a Zionist fanatic and personal friends with Ariel Sharon and all the leaders in Israel, and is an avowed Jewish supremacist. And this is what they do. There's other examples of 9/11 style symbolism that can be found in Hollywood movies and television shows. And this one example I gave is in The Simpsons back in 1997. There's this one scene where Lisa holds up a magazine with the title New York, and it's a picture of Lower Manhattan with the Twin Towers in the center, and it had the number 9. As in the $9, that's the price of the magazine, mm-hmm. positioned right next to the Twin Towers. So it said New York 9/11. Right. And this aired in 1997. And there's a series on YouTube called 9/11 Hidden in Hollywood, which shows hundreds of examples of this 9/11 style symbolism in Hollywood movies, going back years before the attacks of 9/11 happened. And of course, we know who owns Hollywood, Joel Stein, the Jewish columnist in the Los Angeles Times, said, "Jews totally run Hollywood." And he's absolutely correct.
So, you're right. And wasn't it Condoleezza Rice that said, "Who would have ever thought that people would hijack airplanes and ram them into the Twin Towers?" She must have missed that program on Fox, huh?
Right. Yeah, it's unbelievable. Bush said that too, that they never imagined them flying planes into buildings. Then on 9/11, it turns out that many government agencies were running drills in which they were flying planes into buildings. You know,
right.
It's absolutely ridiculous. And there's a few other things in my book that aren't talked about a lot, and one of them is the anthrax scare that happened.
Right. Came out of Merck.
It just happened right after 9/11, a few weeks after the attacks. We had this anthrax scare. Everybody was afraid that they were going to get anthrax in their mail. And they initially tried to blame these letters, these anthrax-laced letters, which killed five people, and they sent it to two Democratic U.S. senators as well. But they initially, the Jewish-owned media was trying to blame this on Al-Qaeda and Iraq, and they tried to say that Mohammed Atta, the patsy, one of the lead patsies, hijackers, they said that he had met with an Iraqi official in Prague in the Czech Republic 5 months before 9/11, and this Iraqi intelligence agent gave him a flask of anthrax. And the only source of this claim was none other than the Israeli intelligence services. So that pretty well debunks the claim. Look who is coming from. And they, you know, admitted that this was, they later admitted that this was BS, that this was propaganda. And the Czech intelligence chief said that this was basically just a ploy by the U.S. government to justify the Iraq war, because they tried to blame it on Saddam. And it turned out that this anthrax, and this is admitted now, that it came from a U.S. Biowarfare lab in Maryland, in Fort Detrick, Maryland. And this was an inside job. This is admitted. This isn't disputed. No Arab or Muslim took part in the crime. This is the official story. And they tried to pin the whole thing on this patsy named Bruce Ivins. After the Al-Qaeda Iraq propaganda fell to pieces, they had to come up with a patsy to take the fall for this. So they bring up this guy named Bruce Ivins. He was actually a scientist at this lab called the United States Army Medical Research Institute for Infectious Diseases. And this is a lab where the anthrax came from, and he worked there, but he had absolutely no motive to commit this attack. He had absolutely no reason to do it. He didn't have a history that would suggest that he would perpetrate this. And there's a huge problem with the story. So this guy is a Christian, this white guy, but the letters that were in the envelopes of these anthrax letters contained three sentences that said this: death to America, death to Israel, Allah is great. So these letters were framed as if they were written by Muslims, they were written by Arabs. But then they blame it on this Bruce Ivins guy. So he goes out of his way. He risks his career. He risks his very life to frame Muslims. Well, that doesn't make any sense. Why would he do that? He had no history of hating Muslims or being against Muslims. So why would he risk all his entire life to give Muslims a bad name? It doesn't make any sense. And what I trace this back to is there's a guy named Dr. Philip Zack. He worked at this same lab back in the 90s. And this guy is a Zionist Jew. And back in the 90s, he had been harassing another scientist at this lab named Dr. Assad, an Egyptian guy, an Arab. And he was sending this guy these depraved poems mocking the fact that he's an Arab, making fun of him for being an Arab. You know, this guy's a Zionist, right?
Mm-hmm.
And he was actually basically kicked out of that lab. And And just before the anthrax attacks happened, the FBI received an anonymous letter which said that this Assad guy, this Dr. Assad, was a bioterrorist and that he was planning a terrorist attack involving chemical weapons. And this letter had all these details about Assad that only somebody who worked with him could have known. This Philip Zak guy who was harassing him in the 90s. And he had a huge grudge against Assad. But so the FBI cleared Assad of any of these charges. This was clearly a fake letter sent to frame this Arab for the anthrax attack. So they were going to try to frame this Arab scientist for the anthrax attacks. And Philip Zak is the only guy that fits the description of somebody who would want to frame Dr. Assad. And this Philip Zak guy was never prosecuted. They never looked for him. They never interrogated him. They basically just left him alone because he had state protection. Because he was working, and I believe this to be true, that he was working for a Mossad operation. He was part of a Mossad operation to organize this anthrax scare. And it turned out that back in the 90s, he had actually been let in to the Fort Detrick lab off duty. He wasn't even working for this organization at the time. He had left after the harassment scandal with Assad, and he had been let in by one of his associates after hours. And then shortly after this, several specimens at this lab, including anthrax, had gone missing, and they never pursued this. They never looked for this guy. They never interrogated him. They basically let him go. And I wonder why that is. That's because he's a Zionist. And this was part of the overall agenda of 9/11. You can't really separate the two. The 9/11 and the anthrax is part of the same agenda, and that's to instigate a clash of civilizations with the Arabs and the Muslims for the benefit of world Zionism.
Right. Well, it's just like the five dancing Israelis that they let go. And then they got back and went on Israeli television and said, "We were sent there to document the event." And so, certainly, when you look at all of the evidence, it's clear that the Mossad and probably the CIA handled this operation. And they couldn't have done it without the acquiescence of the U.S. government. I mean, you don't just. Make all, have the response apparatus of the United States military stand down when 67 times that the year previous they responded to airplanes going off course and whatever, and then all of a sudden there's no response at all. Now, who has the power to do that? Certainly not 19 Arabs who happened to plot this in a cave in Afghanistan.
Yeah, that's the ridiculous fable that they wish that we all believed. But I cover basically everything involved with 9/11, including the fact that the U.S. government and the United States in general is totally dominated and controlled by the Jewish power elite. And this plot, this 9/11 conspiracy, was hatched in Israel. Israel was the only country, the only organization with the power, the knowledge, the know-how, the ruthlessness, the organizational skills to pull off a 9/11 and have it blamed on other people, on their
Sure.
enemies. And they had the U.S. government in their pocket. They had the judicial system in their pocket. They led the cover-up from A to Z. They had everything covered when it came to 9/11. So when Alex Jones and Jason Burmess and other kosher clowns like to say that Israel could not have pulled off 9/11, they're lying to you. Israel could pull off 9/11. Israel did pull off 9/11. They're the only ones with the power to, with the media in their hands, to have it blamed on somebody else. There's no other group or organization or ethnic group in the world that has the kind of power and the influence to be able to pull off such a monumental hoax.
And they're the
And
only people that benefited.
absolutely, I have a chapter dedicated specifically to who benefited, and I simply quote Jews themselves, Zionist leaders from Israel who were boasting and bragging and breaking out the champagne on 9/11, saying this was a good thing for Israel, according to
Right.
Benjamin Netanyahu. Ariel Sharon himself said that 9/11 was basically a Hanukkah miracle of good fortune for Israel. The Mossad chief. His name was Ephraim Halevi, and I quote an interview that he gave to this Canadian television network, in which he is actually asked by this Jewish reporter. He says, he asked Halevi, he says, there's a lot of suspicion in the Arab world and even beyond that, that Israel carried out 9/11. It was the only one capable of doing so. And Ephraim Halevi admitted that Israel and the Jews benefited tremendously from 9/11. And he admitted that the attacks basically resulted in an international onslaught against Islam. Demonization of Islam. So we have, and of course he denied that Mossad did 9/11. All he said that this was a vicious libel against Israel, but he admitted on camera that Israel benefited from the attacks. So we have the Mossad chief who was running the Mossad on 9/11 stating that Israel and the Jewish people totally and 100% benefited from the attacks of 9/11. So you can just use their own words, their own statements, their own proclamations to prove our points. And
certainly,
it's absolutely amazing what they say and what they do and how perfectly it fits with what I'm saying, that this is a Jewish plot, a Zionist conspiracy for wars against the Muslims and the Arabs to facilitate this this Jew world order that's talked about in the Old Testament, that's talked about in the Protocols of Zion.
Right. Now, when is your book going to be available?
Well, I'm not 100% finished yet. It's pretty well done. There's a few things I still have to write. I still want to edit it a bit. But it should be done within the next month, and I hope to publish it within the next month, certainly before or within a month or two of the next year coming up. So it should be done soon.
Great, because I know that it will sell very well. People who are familiar with your work are going to want to have a copy, and they can probably order a copy via your website. Is it going to be available as an ebook as well as a hardcover or a hard copy book?
I haven't worked out all the details yet, but I plan to sell it as both a hard copy and a PDF ebook as well. So
great.
I'm going to make everything available to people. I might even post the text on my website itself.
Mm-hmm.
So,
mm-hmm.
Because I've written it where I have my sources actually linked within the text. I don't do a regular standard works cited where you put the number and then you put the source. I just write out the source in brackets after the claim, after the sentence.
Sure.
Because it's just a lot easier for people to go to my sources and check my information right then and there instead of having to scroll down to the bottom of the book and find the source at the back
right.
of it.
Right. Or have them all at the back of the book, which drives me nuts. Then you have to
yeah.
go back there and find the page. And so people need to have the sources available. And I know that you always research everything very well. You always cite your sources, and your work is so professional and so well done, so well documented.
Thank you. This book I would consider to be better than all of my other work combined. And, you know, I'm really excited about it and proud of it because it is literally the whole package, everything you need to know concerning 9/11. I have a section covering a little bit of the Holocaust myth. I tie it all in with the Old Testament, the Protocols of Zion, and what the Jewish agenda is all about. And this all ties together, and I try to make things as concise and clear and simple as possible and tie it all in together and put it all in one place, because there's a lot of information that's sort of scattered all over the internet. There's tidbits of information on this site. There's an article here, an article there covering certain topics. What I do well is I take the most potent facts, the most impressive set of information, and I put it all in one place, and I interpret it for you, and I analyze it for you, and I make a cohesive narrative, and I put it all together, and that's what I think this book represents.
Well, you do that really well. You have a way of doing that where place all the pieces for us, you know, like a puzzle. And I think that a lot of people just focus on one small aspect of an issue, where
Right.
you talk a lot about everything so that people can get the whole picture and then draw their conclusions. And you're really good at that.
Yeah, I try to have a good range of subjects that I cover instead of just being totally focalized on one specific topic, which is okay. You know, the Holocaust revisionists are focused on the Holocaust, and then there's 9/11 researchers like Christopher Bolin who are totally focused on 9/11. But I think if you, it's kind of it doesn't give everybody the full picture when it comes to all of these things, because they're all connected. All these events that we're all talking about, the Holocaust, 9/11, this is all traces back to the same people,
Sure.
the same cabal, and you know that has to be pointed out.
When I was interviewing Douglas Valentine, he wrote the book, let's see, he wrote about the Phoenix Project. And he said that Bob Kerry, who became Senator Bob Kerry, actually facilitated the Phoenix Program in Vietnam, which meant the killing of thousands upon thousands upon thousands of people. And then right after 9/11, or shortly after 9/11, when maybe in 2006, he was at a function, a 9/11 function, and somebody asked him about when it was planned and everything. And he said, oh, he said, 9/11 was a 30-year project. It was planned 30 years ago. And when you consider what he did during the Vietnam War, then he comes back and he's a senator, and then you know, he's talking about 9/11 being a 30-year job operation. Think, wow, you know, this guy must know something. And when you look at some of the politicians, and you look at their background, and you look at some of their military, how they functioned in the military, you think, wow, this guy's been a real bad actor from the time that he was, you know.
Yeah. He had a sordid past.
Yes, all of them have a sordid past, and their sordid past, and he certainly did. And, yeah, I think he let the cat out of the bag. And, of course, if you figure back 30 years, then you go back to the USS Liberty on June the 8th of 1967, which was, I think, probably a flubbed-up false flag. And you can certainly say that they were very successful with this one.
And in the first section of my book, before I get into the 9/11 stuff, I make sure that I cover briefly, because I didn't want to go into too much detail, because the book would just be too big if I explained everything in full detail. But I covered some of the previous false flag attacks, terrorist atrocities that have been perpetrated by Israel and by Jews before Israel was created. And I basically tie all of the major attacks that have occurred in the Western world back to Israel. They are behind pretty much anything that gets blamed on Al-Qaeda, which is a fabricated organization, a media myth. All of these attacks, the bombings in Africa and the embassies in 98, the 1993 World Trade Center bombing, the Beirut bombings in 1983, the USS Liberty, the Levant Affair. You know, Jews have been caught numerous times committing these false flags. Now, just think about how many of these bombings that have taken place have been successful in that they were blamed on people who didn't commit them. The false flag is supposed to work. And I contend that majority of these major attacks are committed by Israel and their helpers in Western intelligence agencies, and that are being still blamed on the wrong people today, mostly on Muslims, Arabs, and of course the ominous and elusive Al-Qaeda, which is totally fabricated propaganda to cover for this Zionist conspiracy to conquer the Middle East and drive the West into wars against the enemies of Israel. The agenda is so blatant and so obvious when you put all the pieces of the puzzle together that nobody can walk away from reading this laid out like this, nobody can say that Israel is not totally with its hand in the cookie jar, neck deep in this malfeasance and this criminality.
Absolutely, I agree. Well, it's been wonderful chatting with you. I look forward to your book. When the book comes out, we'll have to do another program so that we can tell, so you can tell people that it is available. And you have so much traffic to your website. I'm certain that you're going to start taking orders. I think they'll your orders will add up, and people should probably buy several copies to share with their friends.
Well, thanks so much for having me on, Deanna. It's a pleasure as always. I'm hoping to do more of these shows. I've just been so focused on getting the book done that it's just I don't have the time to
Sure.
do it. But we're a good team and we work well together and we can get this information out like nobody else can. And my website just continues to grow. The ratings are in the top tier of websites. My friend Prothink recently did a study of the website stats, and he found that my site has surpassed even truth websites like of David Duke and The Ugly Truth and Kodo and the Institute for Historical Review, and it's just going to continue to grow, and more people are going to continue to come to my site and your site and other truth tellers, fearless people who just want to expose what's really going on.
And you do that so well, and that's why you have the traffic. And I watched that video and I thought, that is just wonderful. I'm very proud of you.
Thank you. I was happy about it, and I got an email from Frederick Tobin, one of my heroes, who's
Right.
down in Australia, and he just suffered a bankruptcy,
Oh, it's
and
terrible what they've done to him.
they did to him what they did to Ernst Zundel, what they're trying to do to Arthur Topham, what they try to do to everybody who stands up for the truth and who exposes the lies of the Jewish power elite.
Right.
And so, what can you do? All you can do is battle on. Continue ahead with the truth and see what happens.
Right. Well, thank you so very, very much, and we'll talk soon.
Take care.
You too. Bye-bye.